We're testing.
Do it one more time.
1, 2, 3, 4, testing.
Where are you from?
Okay. I'm Richard E. Trent. I'm from Pittsburgh, PA, a little town 7 miles out of Pittsburgh, where I was born and raised. It's called Crafton. It's near Andrew Carnegie's hometown. Where the Carnegie, Illinois, and Jane L. Steele have their headquarters.
And tell about your family, the makeup of the town.
I'm one of eight. I'm the third youngest of 18 children. 11 brothers and 7 sisters. And my parents died when mother died when I was 4, and my father died when I was 18. And we were brought up in a completely ethnical mixed ethnical mixed people of Germans, French, and Italian, and first generation Polish. And
but you were the only.
But when we were the only black family within that town, but we were respected, as our dad and our parents always enforced in us to respect as well as to be respected. And my father was awfully he was awfully strict on that.
What did your dad do?
And my dad was a Pennsylvania coal miner in the hills of West Virginia and southeastern Pennsylvania. And I had 3 brothers that attended university, one to be a dentist and one to be a lawyer, and one went to be a doctor.
How much education did you get yourself?
And I have a high school education. And when the war broke out, I had been out of school, and I had a little white friend that we used to play together, get tadpoles out of the creek, and take them in our backyard and hold them until they turned to frogs. So when we grew up, after we got out of school, we wanted to join the Air Force together. And so we went down to register, and we were ignorant as to the fact of, what I'm going to get to, segregation. They called him, and I went up and talked to his mother. And how were they told him not to tell me, or that he was gone, or what? But anyhow, he didn't contact me to tell me that he had left. So I went down the draft board in Pittsburgh, and I wanted to know, why did Ernie leave and I didn't get my call? So that was when the man dropped it on me that I had to go to a black outfit and Ernie would have to go to a white outfit. Well, I almost cried.
You weren't aware that there were problems.
I wasn't
like
aware of it, no.
Right.
And it bothers me today.
Yeah. Were you enlisted anyway?
So, just a minute.
It's been a long week, hasn't it?
Excuse me.
We'll turn off that machine for a minute.
Well, so I asked him, he said that my draft number and Ernie's draft number were so close that I would probably be going in a couple weeks, he said, or maybe a month. He said, unless you want to enlist now. So I'm 100% American at that time, so what did I say? I said, well, I'll go now. So he said, well, good. And he didn't ask me what outfit I wanted to go to. He didn't ask me what I wanted to be. He didn't ask me my qualifications. He didn't ask me what intentions did I have, want to do in the service. He just signed me up, and told me I would get a notice in a couple weeks. So in the meantime, the Burgess of Crafton, Mayor Dunn, heard that I was going to the service And they said, one of our boys from Crafton is going to the service. So they all got together and threw me a big party. So the mayor got up and he says, we're afraid that he might get in some kind of predicament if they send him south. To me, now I'm wondering, what can I get into? What can happen? It just had me in awe because I was ignorant to the fact of worldly travel and prejudice. I say that now, but I couldn't have told you that 50-some years ago.
How old were you at the time?
About 20. But I had been working on the farm, and we didn't travel then because we didn't have the means to travel.
Yeah.
And we were, we ate good, we were clothed good, but we didn't have any means for any outside recreation other than what we could afford ourselves. Like I say, catching tadpoles out of the creek and keeping them until they get frogs. And so they had this meeting at the Burr building, at the Crafton Burr, and they had a nice dinner for me. There was on a lot of the residents heard that I was going, and I was one of the Trent boys. And I say there was 11 of us boys, and everybody came. So after it was over, he called me in his office, and he says, now, you're going away, and you'll probably go south, and you might get involved in something that you don't know how to handle. And then he waited and looked at the expression of my facial expression, I guess, and I could figure, what can I get into that I couldn't get in any place else? So he told me about the blacks weren't allowed to do this and the blacks weren't allowed to do that. Well, that's something we never talked about. And now my kids know about that. But at that, then it was a quiet, kept hush-hush thing because they figured it was something terrible. And so he said, if I got into any trouble, I was to call, have who's ever in charge, to call the Crafton Borough. Just call. So, okay. So then he must have went and seen the, I don't like to say this, I don't, maybe I shouldn't. But I want to tell you. Of course, I guess you can see that now at 75. So you know what I was when I was young.
how tall were you when you were young?
I was about 5 foot, 5 foot five, 5'4". So when I went to get my examination to be inducted, he said, wow. He says, you're mighty white inside. You're mighty white under your clothes. The doctor told me that. And he was from Crafton. But he must have not have been born and raised in Crafton to know us that intimately. Or he wouldn't have said that. Because I figured, well, I'm still black, really, rather than the inside or outside. So he said, because I had been picking asparagus for 15 cents an hour, which was a lot of money in them days. I had a convertible 37 Chevy. So, and I had a money in my pocket. And so when he said, wow, he says, you're mighty light under your clothes. But I was told my grandfather was a free issue. He was part white and part black, but he was of the situation that they didn't want him in the South because he would accumulate rabble-rousing, as they call it. One good nigger, one light nigger, exciting blacks. So they sold him to this northern Colonel Robinson, that owned a lot of ground in outside of Crafton, a place called Walker's Robinson Run. And he paid $500 to get my father out of bondage. And they brought him to Robinson Run. And my father was a herbal doctor in them days, that they used to get roots and different barks and different herbs out of the ground and feed it to horses when they had colic and distemper and like that. And so he figured he could use my father, and they got to be very good good friends. So then he sent to Virginia and got my mother, my grandmother, and gave them a home and gave them a plot of ground. And out of that reunion, there I had about 12 or 13 uncles. I mean, they had 12 or 13 children, and they had just revert back. And but Mr. Robinson must have treated them very good, because they were very affluent and astute people. My great aunts and great uncles were high school graduates, and they all made a fairly decent living. And that reunion, then my mother, they met my father in Cumberland, Maryland, and then he moved to a place called Walker's Mills, Pennsylvania. And Andrew Carnegie owned a lot of the coal mines then, Carnegie, Illinois Steel, and that's where my father went to work. He left the mill and went in the coal mine, because he had a, well, my great uncles told me that he had a violent temper. So.
Which you obviously did not inherit.
No,
we're getting off the track. You've got an airplane to catch. So let's get you back into military service.
So anyhow, I went to the mill. When I got old enough to, was earning, after I found out that my friend had left, you know, and I couldn't go with him, and I said, well, I'll go now. So that's when I told you, I signed up and was on, they had that little send-off party for me in my neighborhood of Crafton, and and about the colonel, I'm going to Fort Belvoir, or Fort, yeah.
You ended up with a pretty elite unit.
Yeah, so I went, then they had it to, when I went to the 95th. And that was in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And that's where we received our training.
What were you trained to do?
Well, I sent home, I play a trumpet. So I sent home, they were trying to form a band. So I sent home and got, I played a trumpet in the high school band. So I sent home and got my trumpet. And I joined the band after I learned how to hi-ho, 1, 2, 3. And so I stayed with the band for about, a year and a half. Yes. And then they start, after we had Sergeant White, I think he played for Cab Calloway or one of the black bands at that time. And he was a very good instructor and a good saxophone player. And we used to go out and play sometimes for dances at night. And that wasn't my cup of tea, because I didn't like to drink, and I didn't like the company and association with that nightlife crowd. So I sent my trumpet home and had my sister send me some money, and I bought a guitar, because I also play guitar. And I went to Washington, D.C. and went to a pawn shop one of the other, I didn't know nothing about pawn shops. They said, I know where you can get a guitar, Rich. He says, let's go to Washington. We'll get some in the pawn shop. I said, a pawn shop? What's a pawn shop? He said, where people bring it and get their money. So I got my guitar, and after I had that guitar, why, everybody, I was a pretty popular guy, because black people like to sing, and they like to sing the old-time religious songs, plus the songs of the day. So,
no, you were working other jobs in the Corps itself.
I mean, yeah, I was. So then I went somewhere to learn how to sort mail. So then they made me a mail clerk. And then they needed somebody to blow taps and to be a bugler, blow 11 o'clock taps and lights out at 12 o'clock. So I volunteered for that job. In fact, they said, you're going to volunteer, Trent? That's you.
So you did volunteer.
So I unwillingly volunteered. I liked that because it was something to do and it kept me busy. And then I also, they needed somebody to make signs. So they built me a little shed and a little tent and gave me some printing material. And I made signs for for our area, like right turn, do not park here, and don't throw your cigarette butts here, and different. I was more or less a sign painter. After that way, I just melted into the outfit and was doing what all the other soldiers did, train, rifle practice. I was awfully good with a rifle. I made marksmen, and if they were going out to the range, they could never leave me. I would always be going. So when this captain seen, he kept seeing me getting this, and he says, where are you from? I said, I'm from Pittsburgh. He said, do you shoot a lot? I said, yeah, I used to. And he said, well, you know, a light man, small like you, can shoot better than a big man.
Fine. And we can do this right, but we do want to get something on right now. They give us 10 more minutes, yeah. Right? That's your ride that just talked to us.
Who?
Bernice. They're taking you to the
airport. Oh, yeah. Do I have to go now?
No. They've given you 10 more minutes with me.
Okay.
And
well, where am I at now?
Hold it just a sec. Tell me about when you left the LPN and what your job was up to.
Yeah. So then we, on our Alaskan trip, we didn't know where we were going. We had just finished maneuvers, and we all got our convoy ready, and we went to boarded a bus, and went. I think we caught that train in Missouri. I think we bused to either Missouri or to Kentucky. I don't know which one of the two we bused to. And then we got on a train, and we went north to, I remember going, seeing a sign said east to Niagara Falls, and then the bus was going west. We went out through Michigan, Colorado, no, Minnesota, and the Dakotas. And it seemed like we ran along the Canadian border. And we still didn't know where we were going until we started across the border in Canada. Then somebody, through the grapevine, got the idea we were going to build a highway to Alaska. Build a highway to Alaska, we thought, gosh. And to me, I said, gee, that's going to be exciting because I knew it was going to be woods. And I love to hunt and fish. So we continued on until we hit And we crossed the Canadian border and went, proceeded on to, I think, on our, at Dawson Creek. We crossed the border and before we got to the Dawson, we got on this, it was a very rickety, old-time train. It was rusty, and I remember when we marched up, they had us in formation. We marched up, and I, being in the out in the country and seeing railroad tracks are usually shiny on the top, and these tracks was rusty. And I said, they probably not going to bring no train in here. But to my surprise, that next morning, there was a train a half a mile long on this rusty track. And we were all standing there. We'd got off our trucks. We were transported there to the station in a truck. But the station looked like it hadn't been used since 1898. And so we all boarded this train, and we proceeded very slowly, very slowly, to Dawson Creek. So we stopped at before we got there, and we was talking to Pete and some of the natives there, and they said that that track hadn't been used for I don't know how many years. And they heard that some Americans were coming up there to build a road. They said they found it out through the grapevine. And the girls and the people just...
Okay, you started at Dawson Creek.
And we started at Dawson Creek cutting the highway, and we proceeded, we corduroyed, that is, knocked the muskeg and stumps out and lay logs to get a solid roadbed after we dug out the humus, the dead vegetation, which was sometimes, 6 foot deep, to where we could get solid terra firma, and we'd throw rocks and stones. We had a stone crusher, and we would fill this in for miles with rocks to get a solid roadbed. And we proceeded up there to Pouce Coupe and Moose Jaw, and a little bit this side of Whitehorse. But I never seen another outfit, because when we were going, we had forward positions, just like there would be a stump clearing crew, and then a leveling crew, and then a scoop crew that would scoop out the dead vegetation, which they called muskeg, and the dead humus, and they would build a solid, and then we would come by. In the pictures that I'm sending you, you'll see that the stone crusher, and I used to run a stone crusher, and then I ran an R4 tractor that would push the other tractor when he got stuck. I'd run up again and bump him. I was on a D8, but my legs was too short, and they was afraid that I would hurt myself or I'd get too exhausted, so they put me on an R4. That's a smaller tractor, which the distance between the seat and the clutch was one thing that I want to say, that I got along good in the service. My comradeship was good, I guess, as to my young personal makeup when I was young. From there we went to, was it Sagalac? I get these positions mixed up.
Did you, after you finished Alaska, you ended up in Whitehorse?
We went almost to Whitehorse.
Uh-huh.
But we still in Quonset huts. Not Quonsets at that time, if you were near it. If you weren't, you stayed in the regular, I guess they were 10 by 10 tents. And until I came back to Dawson, then we moved into the Quonset huts. But all the other times, I remember the one time we were building an embutment for over a small, we were building a bridge over a small ravine. I would say small, but I guess it'd be about 10-foot span. And we were playing with digging these logs out, and it got cold, and I never noticed it. My hands got cold, and my feet got cold, and I never noticed. I kept on working because I didn't know what it was to be frostbitten. I didn't know what it was to be in the cold. So when I got back, I remember one of the boys that was pretty smart on the climatic conditions, and he told me to don't put my hands in hot water. He says, put them in, but I had already put them in warm water, which I should have never done. He says, put them in cold water. So I put them in cold water, but after that, my hands ached like I don't know what. And I have arthritis
today,
but it didn't get real bad until after the statute of limitations of my discharge.
You better go. You're going to miss an airplane.